Good afternoon, everybody. Figure we go ahead and get started. I think there's still a couple more people walking in, but we'll go ahead and just get started here. My name is Jeff Clark. I am a voice architect with the Microsoft Consulting Services. And what we're going to talk about today is planning and deploying your enterprise voice. The deck here is pretty slide heavy, so we're going to try and hammer through all this and the allotted time here. What we're going to go through is a way to start thinking about planning your enterprise voice, and really start just thinking about planning your pilot. That seems to be a big piece that everyone some get and some don't, and the fact that if we don't start getting the right people involved from the start, it just becomes a pet project for your IT director or your IT group. So we're talking about the project sponsors, and then planning the voice integration itself, and then we'll look at linking your network, and then the right link devices themselves, and then how do we support link ongoing once we have it deployed. And then we'll look at some of the enterprise voice features themselves, and then actually completing that pilot that we started. So again, this is really the biggest piece, is to get that executive sponsorship. I mean, we've seen time and time again where we've gone out and deployed a 250, 500, 1,000 seat pilot, and it just dies at that pilot. You know, it may be a successful pilot, maybe it's not a successful pilot, but there's no executive sponsorship, so it doesn't really move anywhere. It just stays. So that's really the biggest pieces that we really want to think about when we're starting to put together the link project itself, is make sure that we have the executive buy-in, make sure that they understand what we're hoping to gain from the pilot itself. So when we start thinking about planning, and we start looking at how can we connect to the PSTN, that's usually the biggest pieces here, right? Is how do we connect Link to our an existing environment, or what does our existing environment look like? In a typical enterprise, there's always some PBX of sorts, common flavors, Cisco, Avaya, right? We've worked with customers that also have kind of just random PBXs. Maybe they have Cisco, maybe they have Avaya, maybe they have NEC. There's just, maybe it's some Nortel flavor as well. So you really have to start to look and to understand what that telephony topology looks like, right? And we start looking at the existing numbering plan itself. How can we introduce Link into this? What is this going to look like? What kind of phone numbers can I provide to my end users? Is it going to be the same phone number as their desk phone? Is it going to be a completely different phone number altogether? What are the different dialing habits that we have here? The classes of service that the users have come to know and expect. And then as we start talking to the telephony teams, right, the common response is just connect to my PBX, my Cisco or my Avaya, it's the backbone, it's not changing. You can attach to me, but that's pretty much it. But start to look and go, is that the right path? Right? I mean, what are we trying to do? We worked with some customers that they want to actually see Link in its full capability. So they'll want to see Link attached to a gateway or some other SBC that runs parallel with their PBX. But there's other things that you introduce, other things that we have to find out what's the best path for. So we start looking at the important choices to make here. The question was why, and the common answer is just because that's what we do. You connect to the PBX, I own the telephony space, and if you want to get out to the PSTN, you're going to connect to me, and that's fine as a quick test. Right, but if you start looking at a bigger pilot, is that really something that we want to lean on? Do we need to lean on the telephony team always? There's been times where when we do make that connection to that call manager or to that Avaya system, right? And if they're doing upgrades, Link's affected by those upgrades. If they have some outage of some sort, we're affected by those as well. And most times, from what I've seen, is the Link engineers or the team responsible for managing Link, you know, they don't have that telephony background. So it's a struggle for them to kind of tell that telephony team, hey, it's not me, it's you. All right, so there's a kind of a different way of thinking there. You know, the why not? You know, we have that huge dependency on the PBX itself. There could be additional PBX cost. It just depends on how we can interface with, you know, with call manager as an example. It's, you know, we can interface with SIP, but a lot of the more the legacy TDM based PBXs, we're going to deploy gateways. They maybe they don't have other interfaces in those particular gateways, so we have to start looking at, you know, bringing in or they don't have other T1 interfaces in that PBX, so maybe they have to add additional cards, right? And then we have the cost of the gateways themselves. And then we also have the migrating of the users themselves. And there's a coordination that also has to happen when we introduce the PBX. If it is the same number, then the telephony team needs to route that phone number back to Link, right? And I've seen instances where the Link team isn't ready or the telephony team is faster and they will route the number to Link, but Link hasn't deployed that number on that user's profile yet. So it comes in, the call comes into Link. Link says it's not for me. And potentially, depending on how the call was set up, could shove it right back out to the PBX again, right? So we introduce a lovely loop, right? And nobody's happy. So we look at, you know, can we connect directly to the PSTN? Sure. And again, it depends, you know, adding a SIP trunk is, you know, it's easy, it's fast. There could be security reasons why it's not easy and fast, but from a technology perspective, it's easy and fast. There's no additional PBX investment. If we can pull off, you know, if there's a way just to pull off a PRI or multiple PRIs and put in some kind of gateway in front there, you really can start to see what life is going to be like with just Link in your environment versus just having Link and PBX. You know, there are, you know, potential hurdles. You know, we have new phone numbers, internal calling, right? If the company's used to, you know, 6-digit, 4-digit, 7-digit dialing, you know, inter-cluster dialing, you start that feature can kind of go away to a point, right? And you start looking at going, okay, well, I can't hand you 7 digits or 4 digits directly to your PBX if we're both connecting to the PSTN. But if those extensions are actual DIDs on that Cisco side or that Avaya side, right, I can map that on the Link side. So the user still has that same experience of dialing 4 digits. We can translate that to the actual E164 to route it back out. Right, so we can work through a lot of those changes, just really depending on the customer's environment. And then we start getting into one of the new things in 2013 was this concept of session management. So we're going to talk about that a little bit more, but in short, it really just gives us the ability to take a call in on the Link side from a PBX or just from not Link, and then apply specific PSTN usage is to route that call back out, right? So before, if the call came in from an untrusted source, the call would just die there. Now we can actually authorize that call and then route it back out, a different trunk, maybe to a different PBX, to a different gateway. So here we have connecting to the PSTN via gateway. So you're going to see through this whole deck that we reference our UCOP site. I mean, and that's a great site if you're not really sure what gateways, you know, are right for you. It's definitely a good place to go and see what options are out there. So we start looking at, you know, basically, you know, what is a gateway, right? In the most simplest terms, it's just it's a physical device that connects to incompatible networks, right? They could be incompatible in the sense that they're just not supported, not so much from a technology like, you know, SIP to TDM, maybe they're SIP to SIP, but just we haven't gone through any kind of you know, supportability or any kind of testing. So we'll put in a gateway that's in our UCIP site, like an audio codes gateway, as an example, right? And then here we get to allow the gateway to act as a B2B to do all the transcoding. Again, it could be that we're going from the mediation server perspective, right? We're going to hand that call off to G711 out to that gateway. It could be that that gateway is handing off G711 on the other side. It could be that it's handing off some other codec, or it's, you know, a PRI, some kind of TDM interface, back out to the PSTN. And then here we got connecting PSTN via SIP trunk. Again, everything, you know, it starts to look similar here, right? But one of the big things is how are we going to do this, right? Is it, do I need an SBC on site? Does the provider, you know, provide me an SBC? Am I connecting to their SBC on their side? You know, is there really nothing needed? Do I need to have some, you know, VPN tunnel established? You know, so we kind of work through all these different scenarios here. But when you start looking at kind of going more of a centralized voice, you know, the deployment, where we start really looking at where SIP trunking can make sense. Like we've talked yesterday, we had some discussions with Mark around high availability and DR, and that's where some of these SIP trunkings can really kind of come into play, right? Where you can have providers, if I'm failing over from a site in San Jose back to a site in New York, that provider can bring those numbers all the way over for you. Here's just a shot of our UC OIP site. Again, I mean, I think some of the big pieces here that we talk about, like enhanced gateways. So we do some audio quality certification. We also say it's you know, requires refer support. So what you'll also see though is you'll have call manager on here as an example that's on the site, but they don't support refer, right? So that's kind of our marking for enhanced gateways, but not for, you know, all devices or all PBXs on this particular site. We'll also talk about media bypass, where refer comes into play as well, coming up here. So in short, connecting to the PBX, only supported for, again, PBX systems that are on the UC OIP site. Not, you know, nothing technology-wise preventing you from connecting to something that's not on that site, but strictly from a support perspective. You know, we get a lot of questions a lot of times from customers as far as, is this solution supported or is this solution not supported? In the day, I mean, I think from a Microsoft perspective, we always want you to be in a supported, you know, setup. But there's going to be times and situations where that's just not possible, or for a moment of time, it's not possible, right? So from a premier perspective, or from, you know, just opening a case with CTS, you're always going to get that best effort support, right? So, and really what that supportability boils down to is that we don't have the ability to go to the product group with an unsupported solution. Something that we've tested and we said, this works this way, and you chose to go with a different path, and now you're having a problem with it. You know, the CTS engineers will do their best to work through that problem with you, right? But you might be on your own until you get into a supported scenario. So just interop between IPBX and Link Server 2013. Really, again, it's kind of just that same flavor, right? So we can do SIP to that qualified IPBX, or we're going to throw into some kind of gateway, right? That we're going to plug into if we have, you know, some TDM PBX that we can't interface directly with, right? Or again, it very well could be that it's a non-qualified PBX that we're going to use, that's the backbone of the telephony world in that particular enterprise, and that's not changing, but we do want to integrate with Link, so we're going to put in a qualified gateway. So we have session management. So again, we've kind of talked about some of the new feature that Link has in 2013. You start looking at it, just opens up different possibilities for the PBX integration. You know, again, it's if I have, you know, two dispersed PBXs in an environment that they don't have a way to talk to each other. You know, I don't know if that's how common that is, right? But we have two TDM PBXs. Maybe you want a backup for that tie line that connects them to, right? Or the circuit between is too expensive. Link can kind of be that bridge for you, right? So we can actually take that call in. We can process it. Is it meant for us? Is it not? And then we can then send that call back out to the other PBX or out to a different location. So what we have is when we enable this session management or this inner trunk routing, right, is that we can, again, we can take that incoming PSTN call and then send it to a different IPBX. These are just a couple different scenarios that we have going here. Outgoing IPBX calls to a PSTN network via link, right? And I think that's just the biggest piece here is that we can actually bridge that. We use the word session management, especially folks that are familiar with the SBC world, right? We're not a session manager in that aspect, but we do have, kind of like session management light capabilities. So here we go into inner trunk routing. So again, kind of what we're talking about. And this slide is laid out a little bit confusing in the fact that you would think the left graphic and the left text go together, but they don't. So the left text and the left graphic and the right text are pairs. So again, it's really just showing the same thing we're talking about, but more in a graphical fashion. And one of the biggest pieces here is that the media path doesn't have to be through link, right? So the media path can actually go from PBX to gateway, right? So our signaling path is going to come in into the link mediation server. It's going to hand that call off to the front end. The front end's going to process that call, and then it's going to look at the trunk it came in on. It's going to look at its PSTN usages that it has available, the routes that are available to that usage, and then follow the best route back out, which could be to a different gateway. It, you know, could be to a different PBX. And again, the bottom picture here is really just showing you the exact same thing again. It's just PBX to PBX. We can do, it could be gateway to gateway or any combination of, right? But I think the biggest point here is that the mediation server is just sitting there really as just a signaling path. It doesn't have to be there for a media path. It can be if for whatever reason, if there's some need for it, but it doesn't have to. So we start talking about planning for voice resiliency. So voice resiliency, you know, looks and feels a lot like it did in 2010 in some aspects of it. So again, we still have all the native voice resiliency in case of a data center or pool level failure. In 2013, we're building on what we did in 2010. So again, we still have the backup registrars. If we lose our pool and we fail over to our backup, the user will go into that limited functionality mode that we're used to seeing in 2010. Nothing's really changed as far as that's concerned until we invoke that actual failover to get back all of our conferencing and all of our presence information. So we do have the ability to gain all that back, but you still have that same, I can still make and receive phone calls. The SBAs, again, it's another play as far as for the voice resiliency. You know, if we have an SBA in a branch site and we happen to lose that WAN connection, right, all the users stay locally registered so they can still make and receive those phone calls. And that's kind of where you have to start looking at what makes sense for you. We've seen customers that have a really redundant WAN. They have multiple circuits coming in. You know, so the SBA doesn't always make sense for them. There's some customers that have certain sites that make sense for them. You know, so you really have to kind of almost think of like a site-by-site basis and really what you're trying to plan for. I mean, if you're trying to, you know, if you're planning for just a single WAN outage, you know, and you only have a single WAN connection in there, then the SBA, you know, really starts to make sense. If you have redundant WAN, you know, but then maybe you're worried about a backhoe coming in and cutting that fiber up front, right? Then But if that's the case, you probably lost your PRI as well, so your voice is completely down, right? So you start having to really kind of look and weigh those different options, what makes sense. And then, again, the 2013 DR scenarios, you know, where we start looking where we can add that across data centers now. So now before we could do very similar in 2010 where we could have a backup pool. Now, again, we can have that backup pool, but we can also get all that conferencing data back, all the presence information back. So you could, you know, spend a little bit more time trying to figure out why your, you know, data center A either went down or that pool itself went down. What happened that the users lost this connectivity? So here's a little bit more information on the survivable branch appliances. So it's a purpose-built appliance optimized to provide resiliency, right? It's a hardware device that includes link capability. So, you know, it is a gateway. It is a link registrar and mediation server. Depending on the vendor, they look and feel different, but they all, act the same, right? In a sense, there's different management, you know, from the gateway component itself, right? So there's different capabilities, different options from different gateway vendors. But it's really about surviving that WAN outage, right? So if I just lost that WAN outage for whatever reason, you know, my router died, right, and I've lost that WAN, then I can still make and receive phone calls, right? So we've got a lot of the gateway vendors here with us this week. I definitely suggest if you haven't talked to them about their products and that's something that you are interested in, I definitely find some time to go and speak with those guys. We have planning for emergency calling. I think, you know, and some of this gets into more U.S.-centric thoughts, but some of these pieces can be applied without really 911. So our location policies themselves, right? So, you know, we can be location aware. This is where we can define emergency numbers themselves. We can define emergency calling through ELIN gateways or E911 service providers. We can define IM notification destinations for security desk purposes. I think the other big one here is the location information service, the list piece that really kind of helps the E911 service or helps those location policies really make them what they are. So with lists, you know, we can figure out where you are, right, or help figure out where you are. Based off of the BSSID, the MAC, subnet, you know, switch port, we're gonna validate the addresses that you do put in, or you have the ability to validate the addresses that you do put in against a given service provider. And then once those validated list addresses are returned, so when a user signs in, and we're gonna go through some of these flows, some of these 911 flows, or a little bit in a couple slides. That the E911 provider, or actually the list service, will provide that back via that pit of flow response. But a big piece here, again, is that it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, list doesn't have to be just for 911 purposes, right? If you just want to know that, you know, John traveled to the UK and wherever he signed in, he's in building 3 at some office, right? You know, we can provide that information. So you can leverage some of that list information outside of E911 itself. So linking your network. So we've got, so this is some of the stuff that one of my teammates, Brian, spoke about this morning, but planning for network readiness. You know, we want to look at bandwidth planning, exercises, end-to-end QoS, QoS markings, and then a network assessment completed. A lot of these pieces we run into, like end-to-end QoS, that was a big, I don't say big, but it was one of our problems even within Microsoft, where we would have like QoS drift, where they had routers defined with the appropriate DSCP association, so it would respect what Link was sending. But then they would replace the router, they would upgrade, some site, or they would add a new site. Now this site is having poor quality, right? So having the control over that, having a way to manage that is really important. I think bandwidth planning is another really an important one here. There's a lot of, we run into a lot of customers that, one of the biggest problems that we see is that they never really thought about all the different modalities that Link provides. IMP is pretty low, right? So if that's all you're doing, it's not really a problem. But when you start adding audio, or even peer-to-peer audio and video, desktop sharing, application sharing, you start adding enterprise voice. If you really haven't thought about what is this going to look like on your network, or if there's particular sites on your network that maybe you don't pay for some gold car service, or you're not doing QoS completely in that environment, or it's lower bandwidth, you start running into quality problems, right? And then the user's perspective of Link starts getting real low, right? And it's not a Link issue, right? It's a networking issue. I think one of the comments I hear a lot, especially from MSIT, is that Link is a great product to find problems in your network, and then it will. And your users will report those. So some of the network planning goals, right, is to estimate WAN impact for the branch sites. So one of the things that we have here is this bandwidth planning tool here, right? And it's great to kind of go through these different exercises for you and your customers, right? I mean, to really start to understand what is Link potentially going to put on my network. What is that actually going to look like? And you can start kind of playing with it. Maybe certain sites you don't want to turn on application sharing, right? Or maybe you say, I have to have all modalities everywhere. So start kind of giving you an idea, right? And none of this is really live data that we're using here. But if you have statistics of your existing infrastructure, if you do have some kind of QoS system that you're using for your WAN traffic, right? You should be able to get statistics based off of those given queues to know that, hey, now if I'm in my gold car queue, if I have 2 megs, 5 megs available, right? I'm starting to hit that ceiling today. Introducing Link, what is that going to do? We also want to make sure that we assign the QoS traffic appropriately, right? Because you don't necessarily just want to tag everything as EF and off you go, right? So we really want to start looking at the different modalities that we have, right, and figure out what makes sense at each branch site. So required network information. We're really looking at, the max peak level of usage over the last 3 months. I would say you probably want to look at total bandwidth usage. And again, if you do have some kind of QoS service that you're paying from your service provider, for your WAN traffic, that we get that data as well. Your busy hour traffic, so you can size for your mediation servers appropriately, right? To understand what does my call volume look like? Do most of my users' calls, are they out to the PSTN? Is it site-to-site calls? What does that traffic really look like? QoS policies, bandwidth allocations, what's being done today? What are the queuing methods being done today? Right, we want to start looking at the network topology itself. How is that set up? So here's just some brief network performance goals. Right, so these are listed on TechNet. Right, I mean they're nothing. Shouldn't be anything shocking, right? But these are what we would say is our ideal numbers, right? You can go above them in some sense, right? But you really want to kind of just look at, let's say, your peaks and valleys of these numbers, right? I mean, there's going to be you can see if you have a call that has high jitter, but it's a constant high jitter, the Link call sounds fine. There's really no, our adaptive codec can really handle that. Our jitter buffer can really handle that. But it's when you have those high peaks and valleys, right, where you get, also you have a huge jitter spike. The buffer just can't handle that, right? So we really want to start looking at what does your network look like? You know, what are some of the things we can take a look at? One of the offerings that MCS has is a network assessment, right, to actually start putting live data on the network to actually start looking at some of this. There's some customers running too that have solutions today that kind of monitor this, you know, ongoing, right? So here's our network assessment, really where we start kind of going through a discovery session, really just really trying to just dig in to understand, you know, grab any usage data that we possibly can. You know, I've seen, and it's shocking a lot of times that we talk to a lot of customers and we ask for, you know, statistics on whatever interface or whatever branch site or whatever, and they don't have it. They don't monitor their network. So a lot of times, usually when you get those responses, you immediately want to, I need to run this. I need to find out because, you know, chances are you're going to have some bad experience. If they don't know what's going on their network today, Link's going to find it for them, and you don't want Link to find it for them. So we'll go through like a discovery session. We'll go through a usage modeling process where we start using that bandwidth modeling tool. The traffic simulations, when we're actually putting live data on the customer's network. And we'll, you know, and we work with a customer to understand, what are we doing? Do you have QoS deployed? If you do, let's ride in that same QoS path that all your other traffic's riding in. If you don't, then we're going to ride in that best effort queue, right? And obviously, and then we can figure out what's happening. Are we seeing spikes? Are we seeing patterns at certain times of the day? Are we seeing it from different branch sites or different locations, different data centers? Right? We really can start looking at the latency to kind of help them understand, you know, what some of their problems might be in the future. So why you need a network assessment? And again, it's just kind of what we just talked about. Like, you know, how does real-time communication affect your network? It's really, I like to think it's the user experience. The user expects when they pick up that phone that their call will always connect and that it will be a good quality call, right? And if we don't know what's going on in the network, you know, it could be good, it could be bad, it might not be. How do you fix it? I think sometimes troubleshooting voice can be a little difficult if that's not something you've been doing for year after year, trying to understand, you know, what my problem is. You know, the other network admins say there's no problem on the network, everything looks good, it must be Link, right? And most times, you know, in most cases, it's not Link, right? There's some other problem in the network, and Link's just discovering it for you. So how do you identify the need? Really, what are your plans? What do you plan to do with Link? You know, is your network ready? Have you considered, when you're going to build out your network? What are your expected usages? I think the bottom one is a big one. You know, are you going to be reactive to these call qualities if you haven't gone through any kind of planning sessions? You know, is your team ready to support these flood of calls that could potentially come in? What are they going to do to fix these issues? You know, are we going to get to a point where the quality, the customer, or the end users are just so fed up that they just refuse to use the product altogether, and your pilot stops, right? Network assessment benefits. Again, we're validating that the enterprise is ready for UC. We have a quantitative assessment here. I mean, we get real data back, so we actually have an idea of what that network looks like. We can reduce deployment risk, right? I mean, we're potentially finding problems. We're working through those problems as we're running this assessment here. We can highlight areas, you know, that might impact UC. Again, we're gonna, you know, protecting the customer's investment, and then really just again promoting the best possible end user experience. I mean, I think that's just a big key. I mean, it's you know, the phone's got to work. You know, if Link is a great experience when everything works fantastic, right? And it can be frustrating for the end user when it doesn't. And we want to prevent that the best we can. QoS diff serve recommendations. I think, you know, we've kind of talked about this, but configuring separate port ranges for audio, video, application sharing, file transfer traffic. You know, in earlier releases, we didn't give you the ability to really slice that up. Now we do. I really say take advantage of that, right? We have all of our recommendations on TechNet here, but you know, here's a couple of them here, right? Where we kind of talk about really splitting up the audio range and the video range and the server ranges themselves, the environmental factors here. And this is really when you start kind of getting into a design discussion with the networking team. You know, we can always say, yeah, we can mark the traffic on a Windows PC. More times than not, I hear from networking teams or security teams that I don't care what you can do, I don't trust Windows, right? So we can tell them, hey, we're going to send traffic to X server, right, or X subnet on X ports, right? It's going to be these ports always. You know, then you can mark the traffic on your switches, right, or on your routers, right? So we can give that information. We can do a combination of both, right? We can mark by application and by port on Windows, and then they can also mark again or validate. Audio and video bandwidth controls. So here we have, you know, end user maximum allowed bandwidth per modality. So we can start actually manually assigning bandwidth limits here as well. We start looking at wide area network link bandwidth policies, and that's really where call mission control comes in, right? I think this is a big one. There's a lot of utilities in the link resource kits that help you with call mission control. We have utilities out there that kind of help you visualize the CAC network that you've designed. We've got utilities to show you the live data, or the live policies being applied in your network. So you can kind of visualize that, you know, you just at, you know, different moments in time, you can look at it. It's great from a troubleshooting perspective or even when you're first setting up. There's also another utility that you can actually turn on logging. You can actually turn on call mission control logging that basically dumps these CSV files out, and then we have an Excel document that you can actually go and look at it. So you can actually see historical CAC data, right? So you can go and go, okay, well, I've set across, you know, 5 megs or 10 megs of audio across this one particular link. Am I hitting it? Am I exceeding it? Am I not even close to it? Right? So you start kind of really visualizing if is CAC set up correctly in your deployment. What is call mission control? So it provides a better user experience. You can manage bandwidth for audio and video. It's based off of subnets, right? So I think that's kind of a big key here, right? Is that it's dynamic in the sense that when a user signs in, the subnet that they attach to, right, will be the policies that get applied to them, right? So it's not just applied to a user, but it's applied to the subnet itself. So media bypass in a branch site, right? There we go. So the SIP flow itself, right, is from that link client across the WAN to your data center, right, and then back. So this is showing a router. So typical kind of like Cisco, that's SIP. That's not a, it's weird. Okay, yeah, so what we have here, right, is the link client making a call, you know, essentially making a call out to the Cisco handset, right? So it would be the link client up to its front end or up to the mediation server. That mediation server handing off to call manager, right? That router, you know, theoretically should be on the other side. But Then once we have that session established, the media itself, because you know, we can now go from the link client directly, essentially directly to the Cisco handset or to the, you know, to the other IP handset. So it doesn't have to be talking SIP, right? So now we can have a different media path than we have our signaling path, right? And that's really that's the benefit of media bypass. And what you, I guess, need to think about is with media bypass and with CAC, right? They're kind of just, they don't exist together in the sense that when you're doing media bypass, you're within your site, and when you're doing CAC, you're cross site, right? So we'll never do media bypass across the WAN. So media bypass settings here. So here it talks about where it's configured differently based on whether the gateway supports receiving a SIP refer. I think an important piece here, for me at least, is that you can do bypass with a gateway or a PBX that doesn't support refer. You just can't do bypass in a transferred call. So if I get an inbound call or I make a call, I could do media bypass and everyone's happy. Once I transfer that call, we have to renegotiate, and since the PBX in this case can't do a refer, then the audio gets redirected back through the mediation server. So we go through transcoding on the mediation server and that transfer scenario. And then again, the OIP qualified, you know, enhanced gateways, they all support refer. And then on that OIP site, the IPPX gateways or IPPX and gateways will indicate if they support refer or not, and any particular other settings that need to be turned on. Link devices. So USB devices versus IP phones. You know, we hear this a lot, let choice be your theme. I think, you know, it's true to a point. You know, I mean, we've talked to a lot of customers where we pitch that and they like that idea, but they want limited choices. Give me a few. I mean, there's so many possible options out there of IP phones, USB phones, different headsets, right? You know, I like the customer to choose, or I like my users to choose these different endpoints, but let's limit what these endpoints are, right? Let's keep it small. But so trend is towards a soft phone and a USB device. I think that's true for a lot of work-at-home users, mobile users, myself. I mean, I don't have a physical phone. I haven't had a physical phone in years. It's whatever. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I've had USB headsets for so long, right? You know, I've tried other different, you know, decked headsets, right? But it's always just kind of what you're comfortable with. You know, the better UC experience, the Office integration. There's lower cost, right? Again, supports for mobile and remote workers. I think that's a big piece there, right? That you can just have a little Bluetooth, you know, headset, you know, in your pocket that you can use on your cell phone or you can use with Link. Right? I mean, that's a huge advantage. Are the employees using headsets purchased in their own cost centers? You know, they have a particular, you know, phone on their desk, and then they also buy headsets that plug into that phone, right? So that just raises the cost of that station. There's a lot of work being done around having, you know, more of kind of a hoteling stations being built at customers now, right? Where you just have power and Ethernet usually, or right, or there might be a USB handset there just to give you that feel, right? And then plan for 20% of users to have IP phones. I think this is a big key that Microsoft saw a lot too, was that we were deploying, when we were turning on enterprise voice internally, we were deploying physical phones and giving USB headsets. And what we found was that nobody, I wouldn't say nobody, but the trend slowly went away from those physical phones, and we would just redeploy those physical phones to the next group of people that got enabled, because everyone just tended to go with the headset itself. So with one of the things we can do with Link, right, is that you can actually grab your monitoring data and you can view and see what endpoints are actually being used. So you can get an idea, are people using this these phones I made an investment in, right? Or are they just using headsets, or maybe we're not using, you know, qualified headsets? Maybe that's, you know, a particular problem that you're finding in your environment as well. So why choose devices qualified and optimized for link? So the devices enable communication and collaboration, which drives value to users and technology adoption. You know, I think that's a big key here, is that we start seeing a lot of problems with users kind of bringing in, oh, I've got this other USB headset that I got from somewhere, from some guy, you know, I found it, right? You know, and you start running into quality problems, right? We see issues, you know, where customers have bought, a big fleet of devices that they got were a little bit cheaper, right? You know, they were a Logitech device. They weren't the one that was on our site, but it was made by Logitech, so it should be okay, right? And sometimes you find that they're just bad drivers written, you know, and there's certain components that work and certain components that don't. That's going to start raising support costs. That's going to start, you know, just give a bad user experience. You know, as far as they're concerned, again, it's a link problem. It's not my problem. IP phone infrastructure requirements. So here, LLDP Med. This is a big one, right? So that, I think that was a real, for different scenarios. Windows 8 started to support this, right? So this was, and it just depending on the different requirements that you or your customer might have, right? We've got power over Ethernet is supported. But, you know, again, it's not necessarily required, but if you happen to be buying phones that are PoE capable, but you don't have a PoE solution in your environment, right, just make sure that you do order the adapters, and a lot of times they don't come with them. DNS requirements are pretty much the same as they were in R2, and then we've got DHCP requirements, and they're the same as they were in Link 2010, right? So we still need that option 43 and the option 120. Common area phone support. It enables low-cost IP phones to be placed in common areas. So we see this, I think the bottom bullet, the support for hot desking scenario, I think that's really where those hoteling, you know, situations kind of can become important. You can have a phone that's registered that maybe is only allowed to call local calls and 911 as an example. But then I go to that desk, I sign in, now that phone is mine. It has my number, has all my capabilities on it as well. Analog device support. So this was, you know, I've seen customers ask for it, but I haven't really seen that many customers deploy it, where, you know, they really wanted to leverage the analog phones, right? So we have the ability to actually make contact objects in Link, so we can register, not quite register, but we can associate these analog devices within Link itself. So we can handle, the calls will actually route to Link and back out. The media stays outside of Link, but it gives us the ability to view all of the CDR data, right? If that's needed, that way it gives you kind of a centralized CDR view. And here where we have central fax solutions, the ability to remove modems, we start kind of just looking at what is our analog, you know, position, you know, what do we want to do with these analog devices? Should we just keep them where they are? Do we need to bring them into Link? These are some of the things we wanted to think about as we start putting these pilots together. Link voice support. So we have, I think a lot of you have heard the PSLP term, right? So we have this ability now, so with partners that Microsoft certify, and they work closely with Microsoft, right? That now they can become your one throat to choke, right? So instead of, you know, you have a partner come in and they deploy hardware servers and they manage all that stuff, but when you have a Link issue, you call into CTS, and then the CTS engineer a lot of times is struggling to understand the environment, or it takes a little bit longer for them to understand the environment. So it increases that the length of that particular case while they kind of understand and learn the environment from you. Although, you know, one of the benefits of these of this program here is the fact that the same partner that deployed the technology is actually supporting the technology. You call them, they have a channel back into third-tier support within Microsoft themselves. So they can open cases on behalf of you in case it's needed. Most of the times, I mean, they're from everything I've seen, I mean, they're pretty solid, you know, groups and teams over there. So that's not needed as much, but they do have that, they do have that capability. We start looking at kind of just planning for the solution for support, right? I mean, I think the middle line is, I think the biggest piece here is support solution the development, where we get into like vendor selection. This process can take a little while as you're interviewing these PSLP partners, right? I mean, you're putting a lot of faith and trust in these guys. I mean, it could be the same company that's helping deploy. It might be someone else completely different, right? But I think that's really a big piece is to really understand is this company, you know, capable to help, you know, resolve all these issues quickly. And then here's just a small list of, and this grows, seem to grow daily. And I don't even know if this is even the latest and greatest list from when we put the slide deck together. But, you know, these are just a handful of the actual partners that have gone through the certification process. All right, deploying enterprise voice features. Some of these pieces we've kind of touched on a little bit, so we'll get a chance to just go a little bit deeper on them. Voicemail. I think the big piece here is Exchange UEMA is the only voicemail solution for Link. As of date, I've heard of requests that the customers want to see this. I've also heard from the product group that they do have a to-do item to look into the possibilities of, you know, integrating Link with another voicemail platform. What that is or when that will be, I have no idea, but I think that is something that they're definitely thinking about and seeing what they can do. You know, just again, the capabilities of UM, right? It's a lot of the, you know, same what you're used to in most voicemail platforms, ability to answer calls, missed call notifications. We do have, you know, Active Directory-based auto attendance, OVA, the Outlook voice access, play on phone, right? Single store for email and voicemail. Sometimes it's a benefit, sometimes it's a negative, depending on the security of the companies, where, you know, a lot of times for discoverability purposes, they don't want the voicemail in the mailbox itself. So there's different, you know, pluses and minuses there. The exchange topologies themselves, we have an on-premise exchange, you know, multi-forest or not, right? We have a hosted exchange, O365, that Link can integrate with. And then we've got partner-hosted Link or partner-hosted exchange as well. So we kind of have a couple different flavors of exchange. So Exchange UM dial plan, I think one of the biggest pieces, and it really depends where you use Exchange. If you use Exchange strictly from a Link perspective, right? Some of the features aren't really, some of the components really aren't needed. Mainly the dial rules. The dial rules really, like when UM was first, I guess the first concept when UM was put together, it was really designed around kind of like decentralized PBXs, right? So we had all this concept of multiple different, four digit, six digit, you know, extension patterns, right? All this different normalization that we would do on UM. Link, we don't really need to use that. We just pretty much just pass all that traffic on to Link and let Link handle all the normalization. Just have one centralized place where you manage that from. Larger deployments, really start thinking of, you know, is it a good time to start cleaning up and simplify some of the configuration that you have, you know, for E164 extensions, and then for the auto tenant and the Outlook voice access numbers themselves, right? They can be in the same dial plan. And what we used to see a lot was multiple different dial plans from the exchange perspective. You have, you know, tons of dial plans, you know, that they were more region-based or PBX-based. So we start looking at link of more of a, no matter how regional link gets, we can have a single UM dial plan. So we really start cleaning up those deployments. Call mission control. Again, I think some of the, when you start kind of looking at what call mission control is, you know, it's really control for voice and video, right? I mean, those are our, that's, you know, that in its short is its capability. We can do PSTN rerouting, we can do internet rerouting, or we can, you know, fail the session entirely, you know, if that's a desire. We don't control application sharing in here. And I think a big piece here is also is under the network integration section is that, you know, CAC doesn't touch layer 2, it doesn't touch layer 3 bandwidth itself, right? It's used in conjunction with QoS, but we're just managing the link call. So all we know about is link calls. We don't really know about the bandwidth on the wire itself. So if you have a Cisco CAC solution, you know, they have to coexist with each other, but they don't share data back and forth. So planning. So we start looking at kind of the network topology. We got the hubs and the backbones is our network regions. And that, and we'll kind of talk about that, but that gets tied back to your link topology site or your link central site, right? And then we identify the offices and locations, so we have network sites, and then determine the routes between the between these locations via network regions. So we can then start determining the bandwidth limits or the policies we're going to apply. Identify the IP subnets assigned to each of these networks. And when you start building I think the biggest piece here, if you plan to use media bypass, if you have any desire to that, and you plan to deploy CAC, one of the biggest pieces is that CAC, you can say it can handle supernetting in the sense of that I can put in a class B network that's all over on this particular network site or this particular region, you know, and everything's handled, you know, from here. But from a media bypass perspective, we have to know the actual host subnet. So if you have plans to deploy both, then you need to painfully go through the process of defining all those subnets. All those subnets that are defined on those host machines as well. And then again, so network sites require IP subnet information. You know, link bandwidth available for audio and video. What are we going to set our session limits to? What are we going to set our total bandwidth limits to? Then another big piece here is CAC leverages the link edge servers. So, you know, to have if you have edge servers deployed, to have a redundant CAC environment, you need to have redundant edge servers. Because what we'll do is the CAC will actually reach out. The PDP server, the policy server, will actually reach out to the edge server during the call setup to find out if there's any bandwidth available. So if the edge server is down, the call will proceed, but, you know, CAC policies won't be applied. Call mission control for the architecture itself. So again, regions, sites, subnets. You know, I think it's just kind of just beating this one in here, right? But it's all specific to the particular subnet itself, right? Because again, just like with media bypass, just like with CAC, just like with LIS, in the sense that when the user signs in, we're gonna provide that subnet. Back when we sign in to get our appropriate policy or to figure out where we actually are, right? So we define sites, we associate subnets to sites, sites to regions, and then we can build network links between them. And then your policy server, your PDP, your CAC server, that's deployed per central site, so per topology site. So your first pool in a given link topology site is your PDP server or PDP pool. And then again, you know, the decision is always on the receiving side. So that client, when he makes the call, right, he's providing his information, and then the user that's receiving it can then ask the policy server, you know, I've got a call from this subnet to this subnet. Is there bandwidth available? And if not, what should I do? Emergency calling. Again, it's just providing accurate routing and location information to the first responders. You know, and that's really kind of what we talked about with that data when we sign in, when we provide that subnet back, so we can provide that, we can get that correct information returned. Capabilities, multiple clients, roaming, external user support as well. And then we have kind of two deployment models. We have the next gen location, which is just the typical E911 solution, and then we have ELIN mapping itself. Emergency calling. So again, with this particular location, we're going to have all this list information. We're going to have, you know, the wireless AP, subnet, switch, the LLDP ports, right? The enablement process itself is location policies, associated sites, and then emergency dial strings and routes. And then the routing component itself, right, is we're going to do this emergency routing to the service provider itself, or again we can use the ELIN gateway, right? And then we actually change out the calling party with that ELIN ID back to the provider, so they can actually look up the address. So here's the call flow or the process for the E911. Again, so when we do provisioning here, we're going to populate the list, the database, right? We're going to have the SIP trunk connected to the service provider, and then we're going to enable the sites or users. And then here we have the addresses sent for validation and report back via valid or invalid address. So that was that whole MSAG validation database process, that once you enter in the sites, we need to validate that information. Here we have the client sign-on process, where the client sends its subnet information. The registrar returns the list URI during registration, and then the client will then send its subnet to list to get its location, and then list will return this information. And this is the same process. If you take E911 out of the picture, and like I just want to have location-based information awareness, we can still use the same capability. And here we have a call flow, right? In the scenario of Bob is making a outbound call, right? So he'll dial 911. We include that PIDF low information, so we include our location. We can have the IM notification go out to a security desk of some sorts. That call is routed over to a SIP trunk, and then that provider then can connect us to the appropriate PSAP. All right, and then we have the security desk integration. I'd say that's more of an optional component there. And then for the locations themselves, the database is global. It's shared across all front end servers. The ELINs can be added, for certain locations. And then like we kind of talked about before, the LLDP is now supported in Windows 8. So if we have to get port level information from a particular switch, you know, we can get that information directly. And then again, emergency routing to service providers. It's only available in the U.S. And then again, the providers, it's a user-based fee process here. And then there's other options to populate that list database, right? So there's third-party location servers. There's also like MAC address scanning tools itself that will scan your network to populate this information. Response group application. So what we have here, so this is just some of the kind of just the the basic features of response group, right? So we have recorded messages, IVR, music on hold, anonymous outbound calling. One of the new components we have is the manager role, right? I would say I see this used a lot in a kind of in an informal agent process where we're not requiring the users to sign in and out of a given queue. More controlled kind of like team group or hunt group calling that a lot of a lot of companies are used to using from a PBX perspective. There are some limitations or downsides to response group. There are some really great partner applications that really bring this out from what it is out of the box. But some of the big ones is there's no real-time views. There's no monitoring or barge in. Like I really can't listen to a particular call if I'm a help desk manager, right? There's really no agent reporting. We don't have any skill matching necessarily based, right? So there are some limitations. But with that, you kind of have to just take what response group is and figure out where it makes sense in your company. Like if it's a small group, it possibly, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, and the same thing applies for Link 2010 and Link 2013.
Okay.
So I think it's kind of odd that they haven't fixed that. So do you know if there's a reason for that?
That's the first I've heard of that. I don't know. Get with me after, and I'll write that down, and I'll follow up and see if it's been reported, and if it's something that they're fixing or what the process is.
Mm-hmm. And Microsoft said this is by design because of the SIP session timer, which is 180 seconds. Or
right.
Like that. Yeah. So, but still, the partner solutions for response group handling, they handle it in a different manner because they put it in the queue. And then
right.
So I'm just curious.
Yeah, I don't know, but if you have that customer information, you want to get me later, I can look that up and I can follow up with the product group just to see, get a little bit more details on it. Response Group Service, it's a server-side voice application that lives on all the front-end servers. It's installed with Enterprise Voice, right? I think some of the big numbers here is 1,200 active agents, 400 concurrent sessions, 600 workflows. A piece that we kind of talked about with the resiliency with the DR scenario, right? It's not part of the backup service, right? So it's more of an import-export process if you need to re-import your RGS information in a TDR scenario. There's a component called the matchmaker service that runs. So if you had three front ends and the first front end that came up, he's the matchmaker owner. And then basically what's happening is the other front ends, they're all writing to SQL. The primary matchmaker writes, I think it's like every 4 seconds to SQL that says, I'm still here. The other guys write like every 8 seconds. So basically the assumption is if they go to that database and they see that this guy hasn't written, right, then I can become the matchmaker master. Unassigned numbers. So this is another kind of good piece. When we start looking at like inbound calls, if there's blocks of numbers that we're getting from providers or there's blocks of numbers that we're getting from your telecom team, as we start building out Link, if we haven't assigned that number to something or somebody, right, that can actually answer for us and make a decision. Is it just an announcement that the number's not in service anymore, or is it the fact that we want to send that to an auto tender, we want to send it to voicemail, some community voicemail of some sort. All right, so who should be in the pilot itself, right? So we really want to start kind of bring this back to where we started was, You know, we're looking at building a pilot. We want to make sure that we had the right, the right people involved, the right set of expectations, right? But now, who should actually be part of the pilot itself? We want to look at just a broad spectrum of skills. You know, we want to try and cover as many different aspects, of your enterprise as possible. If there's admins involved, right? That manage calls or manage relationships or manage, to have some kind of delegate, relationship with bosses or multiple bosses, right? Those are good people to have, right? I would definitely recommend interviewing those admins as well. They play a huge role in Link, in the happiness that you're going to have, right? So just get all different kinds of, all different skill levels, all different kinds of, users. And then we're going to want to get, we say individuals located near a Link champion. So someone who's excited about Link, someone who even knows Link a little bit more, right? So they can, if they have any general questions, right, they can kind of reach over. Because what we find a lot of times is if someone doesn't know, they don't ask, and they just don't use it. So we really want to make sure that they have a place to go. And obviously you want people who actually want to participate in the pilot. You don't want someone who's kicking and screaming going in, right? So you want people who are really excited about this. And then plan for a successful pilot. Have a plan and assemble the right team, right? Make sure you have the right technical team. Make sure your help desk is prepared for the calls they potentially could get. We'll talk about it here in just one second. We have a program called the Rollout Adoption Success Kit. There's a bunch of tools in there, right? There's a bunch of training in there that you can provide. Load training up on SharePoint site so you can introduce features to your users and you can reference this training material. So if you have if you don't know how to do X goal, right? This is how you can do this, right? And it's very important just to get feedback, right? And that RAS cool set kind of talks about that. Here it is. So it was just a combination of the adoption and training kit and the pilot success kit, right? I find it as you're looking at a pilot, as you're going into the pilot, it's a great, great tool set. Even if you're in deployment, it's a great tool set. Not everything applies, but there is some particular components in there. There's one tool called the health analysis tool, which is it actually connects to your monitoring server and actually gives you some really great data from the monitoring server. So if you're having issues and you're fixing issues, you can run this report and gives you kind of like a dashboard view of what the issues were last week versus are you trending up or down on certain modalities, right? So are we fixing all these problems that we're finding? Ladies and gentlemen, that is it. Yes, sir. Right. I would imagine that's going to be a partner-driven solution. We have the ability to tie into gateways and say, extension 101 on this, essentially on this port, right? We don't really care about the port, right? But extension 101 is mapped to this user object in Link, right? So you can, and then you can apply policies to that user object that person, because you basically shove that call back into Link to go back out, right, from a signaling perspective. So then now we can apply user policies to those users to the same way that you would apply user policy to a Link user, right? So you have that, but there's no presence. If I pick up an analog phone, there's no presence indicator, right? Is that the kind of integration you're looking for? Or? No, I think the physical fax piece, from Link, we essentially pulled out of it into the sense that it said, hey, if we get a fax, we're just going to shove it back out to the gateway, right, to whatever this is. Exchange really has kind of done the same thing in the sense of, you know, they just shove out to a fax server or a fax service provider, right? So they don't even, so Microsoft as a whole has kind of learned over the years that we're not good at faxing, right? You know, and so let's, you know, so I think in that solution, what we've really learned is to kind of leave it, if you want to bring it into Link, leave it on the gateway, right? Hang those things off gateways. We'll take the call. We'll see that, you know, we can configure that object that says this is a fax. So if we get a call, we already know, go ahead and shove back out. Let me shut myself down.